Bloody Business.
Welcome to This Bloody Business. I'm your host, indie filmmaker Andrew Johnson Schmidt. Each episode, we talk to the creative people behind the movies that make us scream in terror and delight. From the best boy to the final girl, these are the people who bring our nightmares to life. On tonight's episode, we're talking to Deep Cuts horror filmmaker Gary Sherman. This is the guy who made the last great practical effects film, Poltergeist 3. Showcased actor Donald Pleasence 6 years before Halloween in the subway cannibal film Deathline, and finally made a small-town zombie film that continues to build a rabid fan base, Dead and Buried. Here's my interview with the legendary Gary Sherman.
Well, welcome to the show, filmmaker, horror fan, writer, producer, spokesmodel, Gary Sherman.
Yep, here I am. been in the horror business for a long, long time.
When do you consider the start for you?
Oh, Deathline was my first jump into horror, and year will be 50 years.
50 years. Yeah. Did you hesitate at all to go into the horror thing, afraid it would be a ghetto for you, or?
No, you know, I was directing commercials, and Jonathan Demme and I had a company in London. John was my producer. At that time, John had no want or thought about directing. He just loved being a producer and a writer. We'd written some stuff together, and well, we started in commercials, and we were doing commercials, and then people, we thought, well, let's write some scripts or whatever, and we did, and we sold some scripts, and anyways, then everybody said to me, you know, you're really a good director, why don't you direct a feature? And I said, how do you direct a feature? And they said, well, write something. I had had this idea. I love researching stuff, and I rode the tube every day from my home to my office, and I really got fascinated by the tube, and I started researching, and I found out that there had been lots of people who died during the initial building of the tube, which was, you know, starting in the 1860s. And then there was another story that everybody talked about in England, which was the legend of Siri Bean. You know, it was a highwayman who became so infamous that, and the price on his head was so high that he didn't trust anybody, and they couldn't spend the money that they were making as highwaymen. So they started eating their victims because they were starving as they were hiding. And so anyways, the whole legend of Siri Bean I thought was kind of interesting. And then I thought to myself, well, why don't I combine the two?
Mm.
And the idea for Deathline was born, and I was on a commercial, a huge budget Procter & Gamble commercial that I was shooting. And the agency producer was a guy named Kerry Jones, who had just written a novel. It never got published, but it was, I really quite liked it. And it was horror, and it was scary. And so I was telling Kerry about my idea for what became Deathline. At that time, we were calling it the Ghoul of Dover Street. And Kerry said, let's write it. So I said, okay. So we're off on this big commercial shoot that went on for weeks, which hit a budget about 10 times the budget of Deathline.
Right.
And while we were shooting the commercial, Kerry and I spent every night at the hotel writing Deathline. So we wrote Deathline. I gave it to Jonathan to read. Jonathan said, this is great. Can I send this to somebody? And he I said, well, I was going to give it to John Daly. He said, no, let me send it. I got somebody else to send it to. And he sent it to Paul Maslansky, who was a friend of his. Paul had just finished a film for Jay Cantor and Alan Ladd Jr. And so Paul called me and said, I love this script. Can I give it to Jay and Laddie? And I said, sure, give it to Jay and Laddie. They read it. The next thing I know, I got a phone call from Jay Cantor who said, we want to buy your script. So I said, well, I want to direct it. And he says, well, have you ever directed a feature? And I said, no. So Jonathan, who sold me for commercials, he was my producer, went in and met with Jay and Laddie and convinced them that I should. He took my commercial reel in and he talked about my background and he sold me as the director. And I wanted to make Deathline for the least amount of money that it could be made for. Because first of all, I was making so much money as a commercials director. I was booked solid and I was booked solid. I said, I'd like to do this in like 2 or 3 weeks. And the only thing that would matter to me would be that this film would be a critical and financial success, because otherwise, why would I leave being a commercials director?
Yeah.
And I wanted it to make a lot of money. So I wanted them to just be able to say, he made this film for pennies. And because I didn't want people to be afraid, because I was a commercials director at the time and commercials budgets were so huge. I didn't want people to think I could only make a movie for millions of dollars. So we ended up making Deathline for, I think, 86,000 pounds, which was about $180,000 back then. And shot it in 3 weeks. It was 2 7-day weeks and a 6-day week. So we shot it in 20 days.
Well, let me ask you a question there. You do have a reputation to be a fast shooter. What's your secret? There's so many starter directors that find themselves trying to achieve a real good pace. What's your secret?
Pre-production. I go on a set every morning knowing exactly what I'm going to shoot, how many setups I'm going to do, what the setups are going to be. I do storyboards and I do overheads. And so I I was a DP before I was a director. And so I really do understand. And I was a I studied being a still photographer. That was what I did in college. I studied photography, a degree in photography. And I got to study with some amazing people. I studied with Aaron Siskin and Joe Jackna and some just amazing photographers. And so I had quite a background in photography. And as a matter of fact, the first time I directed anything, I was hired as a DP on a kind of pseudo documentary. It was a dramatized, it was half documentary, half dramatized thing that I was the DP on. They fired the director and the producer turned to me and said, you're directing. And I got, whoa, I don't know anything about directing. And he said, well, you better learn, because you're the only one that knows the subject well enough to take over. And I took over on it. It was a thing for NET, which became PBS. And it won an Emmy. And at that point, I just thought, well, I mean, the film won an Emmy. I didn't win an Emmy, but the film won.
Yeah.
It's an educational documentary. And it was hard to go back. I was the director, and then I started directing commercials, and boom, boom, and the rest was history, which brought me to London. And when I was in London is when Deathline happened, and it opened. Deathline was an incredible hit in the UK.
Yeah,
it was a second. The distributor was scared shitless to release the film. I mean, nothing like that had ever been done before, and it was Rank Fox, and so they didn't know what to do with it. They threw it out in the second half of a double bill. It opened the night it opened. There was a dribble of audience. The next day, there were lines around the block for Deathline, and nobody was going to see the other film, which was the thing called Nighthaired Child, and which was a pretty awful film, actually. And so most of the cinemas dropped the other film, and we're running Deathline back to back. So there was twice as many screens of Deathline per night as there were. And the funny thing was, the poster was a split poster that had, was diagonally cut, with Nighthaired Child on the left and Deathline on the right. Well, anyways, the theater managers cut the poster diagonally, and so there was this trapezoidal poster outside of every cinema that said, you know, Deathline.
Very modern.
Yeah, and you know, if you go on eBay, you can actually find some of those diagonal posters. The trapezoidal poster.
Let me ask you, we were talking about your visual background and coming into Deathline. You love a moving camera in your films, I notice.
I move the camera a lot. Yeah,
you do. And like, you know, you've got that opening beach tracking shot on Dead and Buried and on other films you've done. But I'm especially thinking about in Deathline, you've got this about 20 something minutes in. You do this bravura move in down in the buried section of the collapsed underground. You move along, and you give us piecemeal information. Some of it matches with stuff that's been said out loud by characters just prior to that, but you're adding your storytelling. You're adding it all up, and the camera just keeps moving. Just when you think, okay, now we're going to get to the character and someone's going to talk, you just keep going and give us more visual information. Was that a hard sell to say, hey, I'd like to spend a whole day blocking out this lengthy move? No one's going to talk.
You've heard me talk about this before. You know, you've always got to give some expository information in a film when you're setting it up. And actually, that shot is reel four of the movie. It's 7.5 minutes long, almost 8 minutes long. And it was written into the script. I mean, I knew I wanted to do that. And it actually is like a two-page, solid two-page description of what it is. And I did want to just reveal everything as a visual. And I think by the time from the moment the shot starts with the rat eating something, and then we see it's an arm, a severed human arm. And then you go around and see everything else in the larder, and you realize that you are in a larder, but all of the meat that's hanging there is human flesh. And then you come out through the door, through a window. The camera actually comes out through the window, and then it continues its journey and following. And I don't like unmotivated camera moves. And you know, the rat started the camera moving, and then the camera moves and it comes out through the door. Once it's out through the door, it follows noises. It sounds that the camera is seeking. And you see the man and the woman, and she, and you know she's dying and that she's pregnant, so it sets that up. And then you hear noises outside, so the camera continues out, and it continues along showing where this den with the larder is, water dripping, and you hear things, and it just keeps going back and back and back. And it's kind of backing up through time.
Right.
That's why the camera is backing away as opposed to, and so you start hearing sounds from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And then finally it reveals where we are, and we're in a collapsed tube station. And then the camera gets, you start hearing the sounds of modern day trains, and that sucks the camera into the collapsed tunnel. And we go into the collapsed tunnel, and that takes us back to today,
yeah,
to the modern world. And I think it was Robin Wood. It was either Robin Wood or Nigel Andrews, two very prominent critics at the time in England. And Robin, of course, wrote for a lot of American magazines and papers as well, who called it an umbilical cord.
Yeah.
Connecting the darkness of the underground to the world above. And it was kind of fun, you know, to do that. And yeah, you kind of mentioned it. You know, Jay and Laddie used to come to the set every day at the end of the day and say to me, and they were always blown away by, I'd say, well, I did 17 setups today. And I mean, they go, 17 setups. Nobody shoots 17 setups in a day. I mean, how do you do that? And it's, you know, it's because I had it all storyboarded and I knew every place I was going to put a camera and every shot I needed. I don't shoot more than I need. I edit a film in my brain before I go out and shoot it. And I don't shoot shots that I'm not going to need. And, and you know, doo-doo. So then they get really excited. Some days I come and say, how many setups today? And I'd say 22. And they go, oh, 22. I mean, these guys made big budget movies. This was the first time they ever made a low budget film. So they were just amazed and they just blown away. So anyhow, then one day they show up on the set and they say, how many setups today? And I said, well, I actually didn't shoot anything today. And horror, I mean, their face, blood drained from their faces. And Laddie says, you didn't shoot anything today. I said, no, I spent the whole day lighting and rehearsing a move that I'm going to do first thing tomorrow morning. And he said, on your budget and you know, your schedule, how can you go a whole day without shooting anything? And I said, well, I'll get this shot done in about the first hour tomorrow morning. And then I've got all of tomorrow, the rest of tomorrow planned, and I'll do about 20 sit-ups after I get the tracking shot. And I said, you know, and it's going to be like 8 minutes of screen time that we don't even have to edit. And he says, what if it doesn't work? And I said, it'll work. Believe me, it'll work. And he goes, okay, well, I'll tell you what, you shoot it first thing in the morning, and we'll daylight it so that before we break the setup, so that we can see it and know that it's going to work. So the next day, shoot the tracking shot in the morning. They, you know, this was back, you know, we had to develop film and print it, not like digital, and no video assist. I mean, video assist didn't exist. So it was all up to the camera operator and me to decide if the shot worked. And it was funny, the whole crew, it took the entire crew. I mean, everybody was on the set to do that shot. You know, we shot it MOS, you know, with silent, because I didn't need a track for it. We were going to manufacture the track. So even the sound guys were pulling cable and throwing hay over the rails so that you couldn't see the track. And I mean, everybody, it was the entire crew was working, doing something to do that shot. So we had rehearsed it the whole day, but the next morning we get the shot. Within the first hour, I did three takes of the shot, and it was sent off to the lab to be souped and printed. In the meantime, I did like 20 some setups the rest of the day. We really moved along like crazy. And the crew was so supportive of me. I mean, you know, I did things on Deathline that were just ridiculous. And the only reason that I did them is because I didn't know enough to know that they weren't possible. And, so anyways, the end of the day, we wrap and go to the screening room, and Laddie has the place filled with people. There's all kinds of people there, including Roger Moore, who they were working with on another project. And they invited Roger and his wife, and there was a whole bunch of people there. And so, and the entire crew, I mean, the crew had to see this. So the screening room, it's a big screening room. It's absolutely filled. And boom, and I just said, we only need to run one. I only printed one take because I knew that take was the perfect take. And so it comes up on the screen. Now we're looking at it. It's 8 minutes long and it's silent. And there you could hear a pin drop in the room. I mean, and the shot's over. The projectionist puts the lights up in the screening room. Laddie and Jay were sitting right behind me. I turned to look at Laddie, as did the entire crew. And he just said, okay, it works, as he nodded his head. And there was like this cheer that went up from the crew. And
you set your pace for that, because in a long, you know, a long tracking shot, it's possible to, like, am I rushing this? Am I dragging it? How did you come up with what you wanted?
Well, that's what we did the day before. I mean, we looked at it. I rode on the dolly, and, you know, we didn't have a real dolly. I mean, I didn't have the budget. And it was also, we were actually down in a real abandoned tunnel. So getting the equipment down there was a real problem, and there was no way to get a real dolly down there. So we used what's called an Alamac, which is just a studio pedestal. You can pump it up hydraulically, but you can only let it fall. You can't raise it. So we put a mini jib, which is just a balanced arm, on top of the Alamac. And I mean, it was, and then we built a platform out from it that the carpenters, so that there was room for all of us to ride on it. And it was the operator who, we made a stool for the operator. And because, you know, I mean, the operator is the only one who could see what was going on. And then I sat on a little platform that they made for me right below the lens in front of the operator, so that I could actually focus on, you know, I had a little viewer, a little eyepiece that, you know, would match the lens so that I could see exactly what it was. And I just had a feel that, you know, and I watched it. I was the audience. And I just had to put myself in the place of the audience and say, this speed works. And you know, it would have been hard to go much faster than we went, because sure, it would have been bumpy. I mean, you know, we had plywood laid out for, I mean, the move was almost a quarter of a mile long. And of course, we couldn't afford a quarter of a mile of plywood. So as we would back up, the plywood was pulled and run around to put behind us. So there were all the grips and I mean, it was the electricians, everybody was working. It was unbelievable. I mean, the craft service people were pulling plywood. And then after the plywood was pulled to make sure that you couldn't see cables or anything, there was straw being thrown right under the camera so that the straw was there and settled by the time the camera passed. And I mean, this was, you know, like I said, it was almost a quarter of a mile that we moved. It's also probably one of the only shots I've ever done in a film that I use the zoom lens. I don't usually use zoom lenses.
Why did you use it on this one?
Well, when we got to the end, you know, we came, the camera stops above the pit where the tracks are, where the old track, those are real. This was an old abandoned station that had collapsed. And so we built our tracking to take us to the middle of the pit. And then the camera pans to the left. And as it pans to the left, then you see the archway that's filled with debris. To move into the archway, at that point, we went on the zoom because there was no way that we could move forward from that point. It would have been, it would have been really dangerous because we were actually in the air above the pit on the old tracks. And it just would have been way too complex to move in. So we had a really good zoom on the camera. You know, we were shooting on Aeroflex and, we weren't. I'm sorry. We were shooting on the camera was like the size of a Volkswagen. I mean, I was thinking about something else when I said Aeroflex. It was an old Mitchell BNC.
No.
Which were huge, you know, and then we had to have a 1,000-foot magazine on it. So, I mean, the camera weighed a ton, and to be able to move the camera forward from that, it would have been like building the Brooklyn Bridge to take it over the tracks like that. I mean, we had thought about going down the platform, but it would have been at an angle, and I didn't like what the shot looked like. I wanted to be perfectly perpendicular to the tunnel, and which was much more graphic and dramatic.
You worked with Donald Pleasance in that. What was he like to work with?
Donald was fantastic. I adored Donald Pleasance. He was just such an incredible gentleman. I mean, Donald was off getting everybody tea when he wasn't on camera. I mean, he loved being a filmmaker, you know, being involved in filmmaking, and he enjoyed every minute. And it was really funny. The first day of the show, I walk onto the set, and the first scene we were shooting was in the police station. And so there I am walking onto the set with Donald and Norman Rossington sitting there looking at me. And so here were two guys that had been in more movies than I probably had seen in my entire life. and they look at me and they, with their arms crossed, and they said, "Okay, boss, what do you want to do?" And it was a challenge. And there I was, like, you know, 20 something doing my first movie. And I have these two, at that time, superstars. I mean, Donald was, you know, had won more awards. He had just won a Tony for Man in the Glass Booth. He had BAFTA awards. He had Oscars. He had, you know, I mean, Donald at that time was the actor's actor. It was kind of before he screwed up his finances and started taking anything that he could get. Donald wanted to do this part. He wanted to do a comedy, and nobody would offer him a comedy. And so I had heard that he wanted to do a comedy. And so when we sent him the script, we only sent him his scenes. And he loved it. He just loved it and told his agent, I want to do this film. And but once we had Donald, everybody else was calling us. That's how we got Norman Rossington. Rossington's agent called and said, we hear that you have Donald Pleasence playing a police inspector. Well, Norman's the only one short enough to play his sergeant. You know, Donald was diminutive. And I said, Norman Rossington? And Norman Rossington starred in every one of those, you know, on the buses and, you know, the Carry-On Gang. And, you know, he was part of that whole, you know, thing with Harry Secombe and Eric Sykes and all those great British, you know, he was one of them. And so I said, absolutely. I didn't hesitate for a second. I just said, book him.
Yeah.
And I hadn't met him or anything. Donald, I had met. And I also had gotten, very fortunately, I had gotten some really good advice about Donald from Roman Polanski. I had accidentally met Roman and was introduced to him, and we ended up having lunch one day, and he was my idol. I mean, he still is. I think Roman is, you know, what's happened in his personal life is one thing, but as a director, I think he's everything that I aspired to be as a director. And, you know, Rosemary's Baby and Repulsion and some of his other films, but those two especially are at the top of my list of favorite movies. And then later, I mean, like the Pianist and, you know, The Tenant and lots and lots. I love all of his films except his pirate movie that I love so much. But everybody's allowed one. I have some of those myself. But anyways, Roman and I developed a little bit of a friendship, and he was very helpful to me in telling me about how to work with Donald. And it was just great.
What was the trick he told you?
I don't know. I mean, we just talked about, you know, how to treat him. And he said, just be honest. I mean, that was the big thing, was just to be honest with Donald and give Donald a little bit of leash, you know, don't hold him so tight, because he'll give you stuff. You know, it's like the darts. I had put the dartboard thing, and I had written something in the script about, you know, that Donald would take do the tea bag with the dart. But anyways, once Donald got the darts, the fact that none of the darts, if you notice, none of the darts are in the dartboard, they're in the door.
Yeah.
That was Donald. That was Donald, and the handkerchief and blowing his nose constantly was Donald, and the hat and working with the hat the way he worked with the hat was Donald. And he was just amazing. He was just absolutely amazing. I'm not much for ad lib, so the dialogue that he did was all written. I mean, that was all written. But as far as his movements and the gimmicks and, you know, and leaning back in the chair all the time like he did, that was all really Donald.
Well, as a visual director and coming from a technical side and commercial work, I know that some young directors coming from a similar direction feel intimidated working with artists, with the actors themselves. They're like, well, there's directors that are directing acting, and there's directors that are directing a film that has actors in it. What has your approach been to work with the actors?
I love actors and I love working with actors. And I did a lot of commercials that were slice of life commercials. So I had the opportunity to work with actors. And, you know, as a kid, I did a lot of shows and stuff growing up. I never thought about being in showbiz myself, but I sang, you know, I was a musician. And so I was quite used to being up on stage and performing. And then I ended up in school, in grammar school and in high school, doing a lot of musical performances. And, you know, I was in a lot of musicals and stuff. And I loved acting. I just really enjoyed it. I never considered it as a profession for myself. Well, that's not exactly true. When I was younger, I used to go to a lot of auditions and stuff. And I mean, like when I was 10, 12, 14 years old. You know, my parents were not very happy about me doing that. And actually, I auditioned for a children's show as the lead in a children's TV series. And I got it, and my parents wouldn't let me do it. They said, no, we want you to have a normal life. You don't want to do that. My dad had experience with that. My dad had been a performer during the Depression, and which he gave up and went off in a different direction. But he remembered all the bad things about doing that. And he didn't want me to go that way.
Sure.
So. But anyways, I've always respected actors. I've always enjoyed great performances, and I had a lot of friends who were actors, and you know, and read a lot of stuff. I read a lot of Stanislavski, and you know, and so I was quite prepared to direct actors, and that was an important thing for me, which also is why I prepped so much. I don't have to think for a minute about where the camera is going to be, what lens is going to be on the camera. I know what lens is going to be on the camera. Lenses are like also part of my life. I actually do I travel around and do a talk about the psychology of lenses and how different focal lengths affect an audience. That you don't choose a lens just for size. You choose a lens for depth of field and how that lens bends light and you know, a 50 millimeter lens on a 35 millimeter camera is called normal because that's what our eye looks like. And when you put a normal lens on a 35 millimeter camera and you photograph, you're photographing what you would see without a camera. And so that becomes base zero. And anything wider than that gives a certain abstraction and distortion. And anything longer than that gives an abstraction and distortion. And I think you have to be aware of how you're distorting the image.
Supposedly that's what Ozu said about the 50, that, you know, he wouldn't stray from it because he wanted to show life the way you saw it. When you're making horror, are you seeing yourself as distorting and you want a lens that supports that?
90%. At least 90% of what I shoot on anything from a 35 to a 60, because I want it to look like we see it. And especially in horror, I want the audience not to feel a distortion. I very, very rarely use wide lenses. I very, very rarely use long lenses. I want the audience to see to see what they would be seeing if they were there. I want them to feel first person. And so I do that. I use, or historically, I've always used the Zeiss lenses on a Panaflex or an Aeroflex. And the Zeiss Ultras, the Z series Zeiss lenses, give very, very little distortion if you get close. Almost none. I mean, you can go to a 28 and get really close to the 28 and there's no distortion. They're just beautiful pieces of glass. That's why they cost $100,000. Well, or whatever they cost, but they're very expensive. And that's really important. It's really important how you bend the light onto your focal plane. I'm a real technocrat aside from anything. I love technology. And I studied lenses considerably. Well, I went to the Institute of Design for college, which was the new Bauhaus. And it was on the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology. And so if you took classes at IIT, while you were at the Institute of Design, you could actually get a Bachelor of Science degree, which is what I did. And I did optics as my minor. And I actually have built my own lenses and because I love that technology. I love being that technical. So I've never shot anything in a movie with a lens that I made, but I used to make lenses in college to just see how much distortion or not distortion I could get different focal length lenses and parabolic reflectors. I used a lot to just play with and see what you can do with it. And which is, you know, how Poltergeist 3, all of that culminated.
So you make Deathline, fantastic film, does great business in the UK. You, of course, have famously run into the wall of AIP distribution in the US and the meddling with your film there.
There's almost the worst day of my life.
Right.
When we found out that the film had gotten sold. Here's what happened. Jay and Laddie thought that they were supposed to sell the film. And Frank Yablans was the president of Paramount at the time. And David Niven Jr. was the president of CIC, which was the distribution arm of Paramount and Universal, or co-distribution arm in Europe. And I knew David socially. Had never met Frank, but David knew about Deathline. He hadn't seen it, but he'd seen some clips and stuff, but he hadn't seen the whole film. And David just thought it was great. And David was quite friendly with Jay and Laddie. So David said, you know, Frank's going to be here in London. Why don't I show him the movie? So anyways, David screened Deathline for Frank. Well, at that point where the man grabs Pat on the tube, and which if you've ever seen it in a cinema, the whole cinema moves when that happens. At that point, they both jumped. And they both jumped the opposite direction towards each other, which was totally accidental. They banged their heads together. Anyways, they watched the rest of the film, and afterwards but Frank just loved Deathline. I mean, loved it. Got on the phone afterwards, called Jay and Laddie and said, I'm buying this movie. I want it worldwide. Well, we had already sold the UK because Rank was involved from the beginning. They were one of the, they put up money to have the UK. And so Frank said, I'll buy the rest of the world. I want US, I want South America, North America, I want all of Europe, I want everything. And so we were like thrilled. So Jay picks up the phone and calls our financier in New York, the person who put up the money for the movie, the other half of the money. I mean, you know, they put up 40 something thousand pounds. I mean, big fucking deal. And they said, well, I'm sorry, we've already sold the US. And we said, what? Who did you sell the to? And they said, AIP. At which point, I think Jay and Laddie and Paul and me just sank in our chairs. And we said, what the fuck are you talking about? I mean, this is not an AIP picture. Right. They won't understand this film. And they said, it's done. Because what had happened was that they had done some other pictures with AIP that had died. And so they gave them Deathline as a cross collateralization, which was illegal.
Yeah.
But they got away with it, and we got fucked. I mean, it was just the worst thing that could have ever happened. And then AIP puts the picture out as raw meat with a poster that you didn't even know was the same movie, and I refused to do any publicity for them. Arkoff flew to London to meet me. Well, he was in London and he wanted to meet me. And I went and met with him, and I walked out after about 15 minutes. He says, you know, why do you want to make movies with people like Jay and Laddie who don't know one end of a camera from the other? I mean, and he, you know, these are the guys that ended up greenlighting Alien, Blade Runner, Chariots of Fire. I mean, you know, you look at all the movies that Jay and Laddie have been involved in, and look at the movies that Samuel Arkoff, and he's putting them down. And I just said, you know what, Mr. Arkoff, I don't want to talk to you. And I walked out and then they set out to destroy my film.
That was my interview with writer-director Gary Sherman. Subscribe to This Bloody Business and join me as we go behind the scenes for more tantalizing tales of horror filmmaking. Until next time, I'm Andrew Johnson Schmidt, and that's a wrap.